You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Medenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story, as he teaches you how to create beautiful images using three lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30-plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access.
Welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swabey. Listen to conversations with award-winning filmmakers, directors from the golden age of television, and creatives from the indie film community who continue to inspire the next generation of filmmakers. And now, over to your host, Damian Swabey.
Hi, Sarah. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Love speaking to brilliant documentary filmmakers such as yourself.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
Good. I'm honored to have you on. I've been looking forward to speaking to you. And when I was editing today, I finished up and I thought, great, I can do this podcast and get to know you a little bit better and your process for making brilliant documentary films.
Oh, awesome. Well, let's do it. Let's talk about it.
So how exactly did you get into filmmaking? Because so many people I've spoken to always thought that, oh, it's not quite a job. It's not something I can get into, or how am I going to make a living out of it? Or even simple things like, where do I get a camera and how am I going to do this? Or how am I going to get crew together?
I guess for me, I feel tremendously fortunate that I grew up in a house where filmmaking and production was just kind of interwoven into my childhood. My dad is a filmmaker and television producer as well, Harvey Moshman. And I grew up in the Chicago area, and he was always producing a television show or making a documentary. And so cameras were around in my house, which I know is an unbelievable privilege. And so to be able to see my dad in action and then feel like there wasn't a barrier for entry for me, specifically as a female filmmaker, I really didn't even think about my gender being a part of it truly until college or after college. It just felt like, oh, this is something that you can do. So seeing my dad made me feel like it was possible. And then my parents gave me perhaps the greatest present I've ever been given when I was 16, which was my very own Sony Hi8 video camera.
Nice, which, I remember that one.
Right? It was great because It had like sepia tone and and like slow motion and black and white. It was pretty epic, especially at the time when we didn't have, you know, camera phones. I sound like I'm 800 years old, but like it wasn't that long ago. So I made my first documentary in high school, actually, for my English class. We were assigned to write a paper, and I asked if I could make a film instead. And I'm sure my teacher was like, that sounds like way more work, Sarah. and it was, but it was so electrifying to me to have this camera next to me and to ask questions that maybe I would have been, you know, too shy to ask without the camera right there, or, you know, just the empowerment of having all this control and artistic say in how the film turned out, from what question I would ask to what soundbite ultimately I would use when I was editing, to what music to add to it, the titles, you know, everything. It was just so much fun to put it all together. And I thought, well, this is great. And because I had such an amazing role model in my dad and my mom as well, of course, but my dad as a filmmaker right in front of my face, you know, I felt like it was possible. So I went to film school at the University of Miami in Florida, and I loved film school. All I did was make movies on the weekends. Like, I always joke that I never got a tan when I lived in Miami. didn't go to the football games either. Like, everyone's like, oh, you Miami football. I'm like, uh-huh. Like, I just, like, I was busy making movies on the weekends with my friends. And that's how you learn, you know. You can only learn so much from a book or from a teacher or from a podcast. You know, it's really about picking up the camera and finding your voice, you know, and that takes time. And it takes making a lot of bad movies, which I've made plenty of. Now it's really fun to talk about the good ones. So yeah, I graduated college in 2008, and I always had wanted to live in Los Angeles. You know, growing up in the Midwest, California is sort of like the promised land.
Yeah.
So I had wanted to go to like USC, UCLA, these like big film schools in California. And unfortunately I didn't get in. And I think life brings you on the path you're supposed to be on. And you know, I made so many incredible friends at Miami that I can't imagine my life without. So I think it's all meant to be. But as soon as I graduated, it was like, all right, let's get there. Like, the dream was delayed 4 years of living in LA, but let's go. So, yeah, I moved out to LA, as a lot of, you know, fresh green film students do. And I got my very first job on a show called Dancing with the Stars, which is Strictly Come Dancing, of course, in the UK, which is wildly popular. And it was a great first job because I was in the field. So if anyone watches the show, it's, you know, there's like these 2 minute video packages that air before they dance live. Of like how it went that week, you know, in the rehearsal studio. So what was it like for them to learn the tango? What kind of interpersonal conflict did they have? Did anyone break an ankle? You know, like all the drama. And so I worked in the field on those packages. So I would be like assigned a celebrity dancer couple for the week, and I would be filming them in the dance rehearsal studio. And that was an incredible job to have as a, you know, I worked there for 10 seasons. So between the ages of 21 to 26, I worked on that show. And the US, you know, it was at the time, it's still on the air, wildly popular, you know, 20 plus million viewers a week, which is insane. So for me, I'm 23, let's say, and the footage I'm filming on a weekly basis is being seen live every Monday night on this massive show. So it was just an incredible first job to have, and gave me a lot of confidence and interview skills. Like, documentary filmmaking and working in reality television are different, of course, but there's a lot of overlap in terms of crafting the story in an effective way, making someone feel comfortable in an interview quickly, you know, like getting someone to share a piece of themselves with you that maybe they didn't know they wanted to share that day, you know, like really capturing the story, getting the shots that you need, the cutaways, the sound bites. So there's a lot of similarity. So I worked on that show for 5 years, 10 seasons, as well as other reality type shows, like cooking shows, dancing shows. And it was when I was about 25 or 26, when I thought to myself, all right, I've learned a lot. I've met some amazing people. I've done some really cool stuff in this business, but I really missed the feeling of making something for myself, you know, like being more in control of the entire vision. Like, when you work on a massive television show like that, there's only so much, you really have no control, honestly. You know, you're a tiny piece in this massive machine of making that kind of scale television show. And I thought, gosh, I miss film school. Like, I miss having an idea and seeing it through all the way from start to finish and having more ownership and authorship over what it is that I'm making. And at the very same time, I feel like, you know, coming into mid-20s, as now in hindsight, as they say, your brain like fully develops by age 26. I'm like, okay, that's a really profound moment in life. And so I think I was just starting to question, like, representation was a big focus for me of women on screen. So I'm opening up magazines, I'm listening to the radio, I'm going to the movies, watching TV, all of the way I interact with media, and thinking, why are women represented in this false way? You know, why are women so over-sexualized, objectified, ignored? Like, where are all of our stories and all of their complexity and beauty? Why aren't they really being told in this profound way that I wish they were? It was around that time when I started to feel the empowerment of, like, what if I go and tell those stories? Like, why am I waiting for someone else to call? Like, why am I waiting around for some opportunity that will never come? Like, if I have an idea and I have some skills and, you know, some kind of gusto, like, let's do it ourselves. So that's really where my head was at, I'd say, in 2012, 2013. And I came up with the idea to make my first feature-length documentary, which is called The Empowerment Project. So yeah, that's kind of my like origin story.
Excellent. I love your story and I love your courageous nature. A lot of people, when they're in certain situations, think to themselves, I've got a vision, but I don't want to rock the boat in my life. So I'm going to stay here and make these videos for the network, which is obviously guaranteeing a certain security that being an independent filmmaker doesn't give filmmakers.
Exactly. So
when you did decide to make that decision, I should say before you decided to make that decision, was there a situation where you could try and maybe say to your bosses, how about we do it this way? And were they resistant or were they encouraging to a certain degree?
Sure. I mean, of course they were encouraging, but when it's a show of that size and magnitude and pattern, remember, like, it's like thinking about this massive machine, there's only so much room for things to be different. So every week, me and my fellow producers would pitch ideas and try to come at the dancing from a different way. Like, what if they go do this excursion? Or what if we try this? So there's definitely room for creativity within the structure of a massive, successful television show like that. But not in the way, it just wasn't the format for the kinds of stories I wanted to tell. Like, it just didn't match up. It wasn't the right forum for that. So I just knew that if I wanted to make documentaries and really spotlight on women's stories that weren't being told in a longer form, that just wasn't going to be the place for it. And so recognizing that was pretty profound for me and thinking like, okay, well, what would that look like? What would it look like if I wasn't afraid to fail? That became the tagline of the Empowerment Project, which is, what would you do if you weren't afraid to fail? And I think so many of us need to ask ourselves that at many points in our careers and our lives. And for me, it was, well, I would make the film that I wish I had seen when I was in middle school. I would make the film I wish I had seen in high school, in college, as an adult, you know, like, what is that film that I wish I had seen? And that it's just like when you sort of open up your brain to like, what if I was able to make that film? What would that film be? And for me, it was, I would drive across the United States with four other female filmmakers in a minivan, and we would interview those women. We'd find those women whose stories aren't being told, like strong female role models. And the crux of this was also, I wanted to interview, quote, ordinary women. And I don't mean that in any kind of, you know, condescending way. I mean it like everyday women who are truly extraordinary. Like, that's the whole point, is that you've never heard these women's stories, and why not? You know, like, I wanted to do sort of the anti Dancing with the Stars, if you will, like the anti celebrity. I wanted to do the opposite and not focus on celebrities or even like Fortune 500 CEOs, which, by the way, there are so few that are women. Like, I can't name a single one off the top of my head, maybe the woman who runs Pepsi, but otherwise, like, there's so few. Those stories deserve to be told as well. But to me, it was like, how do we find like a pilot and an athlete and an astronaut and a mathematician? Like, how do we celebrate and honor these stories of women who are out there in the world, paving a path, being pioneers, trailblazing, and setting the stage and being role models for the next generation? But if we never hear their stories, then how can we be inspired by them? How can we follow in their path? And, you know, the Gina Davis Institute always says, their whole tagline is, if you can see it, you can be it. And that's it, you know, for all of us. And not just women, you know, in any form of representation of marginalized people in any capacity, it's so powerful when you see a version of yourself reflected on screen. And there certainly are more, you know, representations of women on screen these days, but there's still not enough. There's still so much work to be done. And in 2013, you know, it just felt like there was this hunger for that. And I'm glad I had, I was bold and naive at the same time. I love that combination, because you need that little bit of naivete to get started. Otherwise, like, if you had told me how hard it would be to make the film, how many steps I'd have to take to get it done, blah, 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 I would have been like, oof, okay, maybe not. Yeah. But you don't know how hard it's going to be when you start, and that's good, you know. Now I'm a little more seasoned. I have a lot more wisdom now, and it's honestly harder to get started now in certain ways, because I know so much, because I know how hard it's going to be. So it's at that time in my life, you know, 26 years old, I just gotten married, I didn't have kids yet. Like, we set off across the US on this amazing road trip for a month, And we interviewed 17 women in total in 1 month. We drove over 7,000 miles through 22 states. And it was just such a dream come true. Like, I miss it. I wish I could get in the minivan right this second and take the exact same trip. Like, it was just so wonderful.
I can see you doing it again one day.
Please, yeah, I would love to. Maybe my daughter and I will get in the minivan and we'll do like a mother-daughter version.
Excellent.
So anyway, we filmed for a month. So it was, we did a Kickstarter campaign to fund the trip. So, you know, I left Dancing with the Stars. I did 10 seasons on the show. My last season on the show, I was raising money throughout. You know, I'm like filming with one hand and like tweeting with the other to raise money for this big dream. And I got married, and then it was like, we had a pre-production for a couple months. Like, okay, so great. We've raised some money, which was a lot, very hard on Kickstarter. Okay, so what are we going to do with the money? Now we've got all these people that are relying on us to actually deliver on the promises we made from the campaign. We raised like $28,000 from 400 people. So now all of a sudden we have 400 people that said, yes, I believe in you guys, let go for it. And we're like, okay, now we got to actually go make a film. Let's do this. So it was 2 months of pre-production. Like, okay, where are we going to travel to? Who are we going to interview? We wanted to plan as much as we could, but still leave some room, you know, for things to change while we went. But we were either filming all day or driving all day. We got back October 3rd, 2013. And then I was in post-production, so editing with an editor for about 6 months. You know, not full time, but like as a heavy part time, we'll say. And then we finished the film in April 2014. And that's where things got really interesting. I'd say the biggest challenge of editing the film was that we had such a profound experience making it, the five of us in the minivan. And then I came back October 3rd, 2013 with all these hard drives. And I just remember so specifically looking at these hard drives that were filled with footage and interviews and B-roll. And like, we also filmed ourselves behind the scenes and how we were feeling. It was so much good stuff. But I just remember looking at those hard drives and thinking like, oof, will the audience ever feel what we felt? Like, is there a movie in there? You know, like, because how do you translate that to an audience? Like, we had this month long empowerment extravaganza, and it's like, then you got all this footage and you're like, is it in there? Like, did I dream that? Like, will people actually feel what we felt? Like, that was the challenge of like, how do you translate that feeling to the audience? And that was the journey of the edit. And I hope ultimately we did. And I can kind of say now, all these years later, I think we did. But that was the big challenge, is like, okay, we had this profound experience, but was it all because we were just there and in person? Or is this a movie? Like, can we actually, you know, give that feeling to the audience? And so, we finished the film in April 2014. And instead of just throwing it up online, or, you know, we applied to some film festivals and we didn't really get in. And we had this just sort of revelation that the film was really by design meant to be in schools. It was meant to be in organizations and corporations and workplaces. Like, it really wasn't meant to just be put on YouTube and like hope that people find it. Like, we just kind of had that ethos from the start that this was like really educational in nature. And we knew in our hearts that like the audience wasn't just going to find it. You know, we didn't have any kind of marketing budget. So this is like a tiny film. Like, how are we going to stand out? And so we ended up working with this incredible distributor. They're called IndieFlix, and they're based in Seattle. And the CEO, Sheila Andreen, really became like a mentor of mine. And with her help, her team's help, we did really the unconventional route, which is educational distribution for a few years, and still are in some ways. So we started screening the Empowerment Project in schools, like going right to a middle school and showing it to the exact audience we wanted to reach. And we showed it in high schools and colleges and universities and workplaces and in a yoga studio to five people and in a stadium of 16,000 people at We Day California and everything in between. Like, we've seen every iteration of this, from a Girl Scout troop to, you know, Charles Schwab, the financial company, showing it on their lunch hour to their employees. So it just taught me everything about grassroots distribution, and that you don't need to have hundreds of thousands of dollars for a marketing budget if you're willing to kind of roll up your sleeves and put in the work to get your film out to the world. And so there's been so many wonderful moments of reflection, but the perfect example would have to be like in Seattle, we showed the film, we did like a whole tour fall of 2014, where we went to four cities and we screened the film like sometimes three times a day. It was amazing. And Dana Cook, the producer of the film, and I would go on the road and travel with the film, and it was so much fun. But once we were in Seattle, this young woman who couldn't have been more than 16 came up to us and said, you know, I've never seen a female astronaut. Like, I didn't even know that women could be astronauts. I guess she was like, I just want you guys to know, I think I want to be an astronaut. And we were just so blown away. Like, we just couldn't believe that our film had caused that moment. Yeah. So that, and that's it. Right. And we've had a thousand moments similar to that since then, but that's the crux of it, of like that girl saw that film and she saw some potential in herself from seeing this woman, Dr. Sandy Magnus, who's in our film, who's an astronaut. I mean, how profound is that, that if you can see it, you can be it. So yeah, that's the Empowerment Project kind of in a nutshell, is like, it was just this tiny idea inside me and then developing it and growing it and getting it out to the world and finding our audience and just letting it grow has been just such an incredible journey.
Incredible indeed. One of the things I'm thinking when you said, you know, the four of you, well, you and four others, sorry, mm-hmm. got in the car and just drove. How did you find these people? How do you know you can get in a car of these people and do that for a month? Because I've got some family and friends that love them, but I don't know about that, you know, for a month.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it was sort of a unique search in that way. Like, I'm a big fan of not hiring people just based on the credits on their resume. Like, that doesn't mean as much to me as their spirit and their energy and their passion.
I completely agree.
Yeah. Also for me, like, it was my first feature directing. So it kind of felt silly for me to be like, oh, you've never produced a feature, then you can't be with us, you know. Like, it just felt like I'm taking a gamble on myself, so why not take a gamble on them too, you know. And so it's just this wonderful group of women. And so Dana Cook and I had known each other many years, and we had made a couple short documentaries together before the Empowerment Project. So we were very much, you know, on the journey together. And then we hired Ashley, Alana, and Vanessa, who are with us in the minivan, and they came to us through different channels, whether it was like a referral from a friend or a job posting. But yeah, I just kind of believe that they were the ones that were meant to be in the minivan, and we found the right people, and they brought so much to it. And we just all shared in the experience together. And it was really like all hands on deck. Like, we all helped each other in so many beautiful ways. It wasn't like a super compartmentalized, like, oh, that's your job. Like, we were all in it, in the minivan together. So it's tough to live with anyone for a month in that intensity, but we didn't sleep in the minivan, thankfully. We like had accommodations. So we tried to give each other some distance whenever possible, but yeah, they were amazing.
And that's great. So at times you're in motels, hotels, or mm-hmm. how did it work? Camping?
Actually Airbnb, no camping. Airbnb was, you know, ramping up at that time. And so actually Dana and Ashley, our producers, would reach out to people on Airbnb, and I would as well, saying like, hey, we're these five women, we're doing this project. If your Airbnb is not booked this night or these two nights, would you be open to letting us stay there or like giving us a discount? And, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask. You can always end up paying, right? So we stayed with some Kickstarter backers. We stayed, you know, went to cities. Yeah, we went to cities where we had family. You know, we did everything we could to keep our budget as low as possible. But if I remember correctly, it was a month on the road. We never slept in the minivan. Five women. I want to say we only spent like $200 on housing. Like, we were hustlers. Like, we really made it work, because that's all the money we had. Like, it just, it's funny in hindsight being like, how did we make this money for so little, make this movie for so little? But when you just don't have it and your back's against the wall, you friggin' figure it out. So yeah, we always had beds to sleep in, and nobody had to share a bed. And we figured it out. Yeah. So I think, again, the being bold and naive, that part really served us.
How did you approach as a team the women you wanted to speak to? Because it's such a original idea that you've all thought of. Was there any difficulties getting people to speak to camera, or did they all kind of embrace your situation and your project?
Yeah, I'd say most women that we approached were flattered, interested. It was honestly came down to like scheduling and logistics, because we were only in each city for such a short period of time. So if it didn't work out, like if we're going to be in Colorado on September 10th and 11th, and they weren't available those days, like then it just wouldn't work, you know, like, so that was hard, is that we had this path kind of sketched out of where we wanted to go. And then we would adjust it based on the women that we were finding. So it was just a bit of, I would say, just like a puzzle to put together. We had like a big map on the wall and put little pins in it. Like, okay, we're going to start in LA, we're going to end in New York, but there's so many different ways you can drive across the US to do that. Right. So, and we knew we wanted to stop in Chicago. That's where my parents are. And that's where Dana lived. So it's sort of like we had this beginning, middle, and end. And then it was filling it all in and figuring out, okay, like we really want to get an astronaut. Okay. An astronaut, the one we found, Dr. Sandy Magnus, she's in Washington, D.C. Okay, great. We're going to go to D.C. Like, so it was just figuring out the path and then filling in the blanks. And, you know, some women we'd approach with one email, like we found this incredible athlete, Casey Cleveland in Bellingham, Washington. And, you know, we emailed her like, hey, we're making this thing. Do you think we could come interview you? And she's like, yeah, come on by. Like sometimes it was just like day of, so easy. Yeah. And then other people like Admiral Michelle Howard, of course, you know, we had to go through multiple layers of approval in the Navy to get her to agree, rightfully so. And we literally got 30 minutes with her in Arlington, at the Arlington National Cemetery, at the Women's Memorial. Like, what an honor. So that took weeks to solidify. And that was one where we were like, okay, we're already going to DC. We have some other interviews scheduled. We hope to be able to fit that in if she says yes. And then only a few days before, I want to say, we solidified it. And then it was like, great, we're going to figure this out. So all different iterations of planning. That's all just under the umbrella of producing, though. It's just, how do we make this happen? What are we doing? And then even whether, you know, actually Boulder, Colorado had like one of their worst flooding, like 100-year flood or something, the day that we were supposed to go there. So we had to reroute to Salt Lake City at one point, and we ended up adding in a ballerina, Beck Ann Sisk. So that's honestly my favorite part of every experience in documentary, is just like, my dad always said, if you make the film you set out to make, you did it wrong. And that's really cool. Yeah. In documentary, I love that, because in narrative, because I'm working in narrative as well, it's the opposite. Like, you really are kind of making the film you set out to make if you did it right.
Yeah.
And in documentary, it's like the whole point is that these are real people and this is happening in real time. And so it's evolving. And why would it be exactly as planned? It's going to change. That's the nature of life. So there's something really beautiful about that.
I'm going to quote him. I like that one.
Yes. I don't think he made up the quote, but I love it.
Okay. So you're used to situations where 3, 4, 2 women are sharing, not a home, maybe a car or a boat.
I like where you're going with this. Excellent segue.
Thank you. So do you think certain women may have seen this documentary and thought to themselves, we can work with Sarah because we have a certain project that we want to embark on?
Yeah, it sort of worked that way. But basically in January 2015, so I finished Empowerment April 2014, and we started screening it, and we were doing so many cool things with it in the world. And then I get this email, January 2015, from Fiona Tatton, who's actually UK-based. She does a blog in the UK called Womanthology. She's amazing. And she had interviewed me about the Empowerment Project. So she was very familiar with my work and my mission and all that I want to do to support women on screen. And she just sent me this very innocent email saying, hey, Sarah, I just heard about these 4 women. They're called the Coxless Crew. And they're about to set off on this journey to physically row a boat, no sail, no motor, row across the entire Pacific Ocean from America all the way to Australia. I thought you might want to know about it. It was like the most innocent email, just like, P.S. this amazing thing's happening. And I remember reading that email and being like, wait, what? Like, I cannot express enough, Damien, how little I knew about rowing, how little I knew about people doing this in any capacity. I just had no knowledge. And I thought, well, this is amazing. How is it possible? Like, is someone telling their story? Like, what do they need from me? Do they want to talk to me? Like, what's the connection here? And sure enough, Fiona connected the dots, and I ended up, you know, speaking with Laura and Natalia, 2 of the rowers, the next day. And I had very little expectation going into this Skype call, saying like, hey, maybe they just want to know what GoPro to buy. Like, surely someone is, someone must be telling the story. Like, it's sort of that idea of like, we all think, oh, someone else has got that. Someone else is going to handle that, you know? Yeah. And it's definitely not me. And by the end of that Skype, I just was so inspired. I don't think I've had that feeling since, of being like, wow. I have to do this. Like, somehow no one was telling that story, and that they were going to be leaving from San Francisco, California, which is not too far from me in LA. And they were going to row all the way across the entire Pacific Ocean, over 8,000 miles, all the way to Australia. And they were poised to be the first team of four to ever do it. They were going to row 24 hours a day, 2 hours on, 2 hours off, for at the time they thought it was going to take 6 months. And I just remember thinking, like, how is it possible no one is telling the story? And I guess if no one's telling the story, then I'm going to. Like, this is too extraordinary to pass up. It felt like a golden ticket had landed in my lap. Like, I just couldn't believe. And on top of that, I thought Laura and Natalia, and then I quickly met the other two, Emma and Izzy. I just thought they were so wonderful. And I saw so much of myself in them. Like, they were ordinary women doing something extraordinary. It was the same thing, really, just with a different format, but it was the same story to tell, of women doing something bigger than themselves and challenging themselves and wanting to achieve the impossible. And I was just so taken by them and so inspired. That even though I had no idea how I was going to pull it off, I just said, let's figure this out, you know, let's do this. So somehow, you know, 3 months later, that was January 2015, April 20th, 2015, I watched them row away in the middle of the night in San Francisco because of tides, who knew? Mm. And I had spent essentially my life savings on cameras and hard drives and microphones, so that they could tell their own story on the boat. I had less than 3 months. I was traveling with the Empowerment Project the entire time. I was like essentially in pre-production on Losing Sight of Shore. And so I didn't have time to fundraise. You know, I didn't have time to pitch this to production companies. All I had time to do was take action, you know, and to get ready. And so it was, in short, an adventure of a lifetime making this film. And I
can imagine.
Yeah. I mean, for those that haven't seen it, I mean, they left from San Francisco, April, 2015. It was a 3-stage row. So they rowed from San Francisco to Hawaii, Hawaii to the island of Samoa, and Samoa all the way to Cairns in Australia. And I was not on the boat with them, to be very clear. I was not on the boat. There was no camera boat, no follow boat, no Coast Guard, you know, looming nearby. They were completely alone out on the ocean. They had shore support, this wonderful person named Tony Humphreys, who was tracking them every second of every day, like, so he knew where they were in the world. And they would blog every day, which was really like my lifeline because I wasn't on the boat. So every day they would upload their blog to their website with the sliver of internet they had. And that way I could read about what they were going through emotionally. Like, they took turns writing the blog every single day. And so I could read their blog and see their GPS tracker and where they were in the world. And so essentially I was directing this film from thousands of miles away.
Gosh, that is an experience I've never heard of.
It's funny because once COVID came around and everyone's like, oh my God, remote production. I was like, LOL, you guys, I've been doing this for a long time. So this is nothing new. But yeah, it was, so I taught them how to use the camera. None of them are filmmakers. Natalia on the boat was really my liaison. She was a photographer in some form. She's amazing. But they're, you know, filmmaking is different. Remembering to turn the microphone on, learning how to download footage, like, all of that is not normal and natural, especially when you're busy rowing an ocean. So
yeah,
it truly is still, as I'm saying this out loud all these years later, a miracle that there's a film on the other end of this, because so many things had to go right. Plenty of things went wrong, but so many things had to go right for me to even have this conversation with you right now. And that's never lost on me, is like, this film just wouldn't exist for a myriad of reasons, including what if they didn't make it?
Yeah, that would have been really sad. And there were times when I kind of thought, well, this has to have a happy ending. Like,
yes, let's hope.
It did feel like at sometimes well, how are they going to get through this?
Yeah, it really was like the hero's journey. I really tried to edit it as if it was a narrative film in so many ways, because it really was this like three act structure. And it really is like the hero's journey. Like, are they going to make it from here to there? And even if you can assume, spoiler alert, that they make it all the way to Australia, it's still about the journey and like, how did they get there and how do they do it and what happens along the way, you know?
What things did go wrong on a technical side? Because the sound is amazing.
Oh my God. Thank you. What a compliment. Yeah, it was so many things. Well, first of all, I would say at the beginning, so they left San Francisco and I had taught them how to use all the gear. And then 16 days in to their journey, they ended up having to turn back into land and go to Santa Barbara, which at the time felt like a nightmare, but ended up to be such a blessing because I got, and I live in LA, so I'm only 90 minutes from there. So it's not like if they had left from the UK, they're all from the UK and South Africa. If they had left from the UK somehow, it would have been incredibly inconvenient for me to 16 days later go back, but this was actually quite convenient. So I went to Santa Barbara and what an opportunity, right? I took the hard drives and said, well, let's see what you've filmed so far as you're fixing your boat and figuring out how to get back out. I'd like to see what you filmed so far. And so I like plugged in the hard drives. Sure enough, Damien, everything was out of focus. They forgot how to turn the microphone on, like all of it.
Yeah.
And it was like a trial run. So like, what a blessing to be like, okay, let's review, you know? So instead of having, you know, 55 days of crappy footage from San Francisco to Hawaii, I had 16 days of not so great footage that we could improve upon, right? So
yeah.
I got to teach them again, you know, how to use the equipment, but not just that, you know, I really wanted them to embrace that they were storytellers. And I saw in the footage that everything was, excuse the pun, very like surface level, right? It was like, the wind is this, the water is this, the waves are this, the weather. None of it was about who are these women? Why are they taking this journey? And what does it look like when things don't go right? You know, it was just like, that was, to me, this was never going to be a documentary about rowing. And I know that sounds crazy because it's 92 minutes of rowing, but it's not a film about rowing. So it's even funny to me when the film is categorized as like an extreme sports film. And it's like, yes, okay. But rowing to me was always the vessel to tell a different story, a vessel to tell a story about the power of the human spirit, right? Rowing is just the backdrop. And so how do you do that? You don't just talk about the wind and the boat, right? You talk about who are you as people. And so that takes time. That takes time to develop. That doesn't happen on day one, especially when I, as the director, am not there with them. So that was an excellent lesson in directing from afar, sure. But also just how do you embrace being a storyteller? How do you encourage someone to pick up the camera in a really vulnerable moment when that doesn't come naturally to anyone, but especially to them? So it was really beautiful to see how the footage evolved over time. And by the time they got to Hawaii and I'm collecting the hard drives, I'm like in tears, right? Watching, of course, the beautiful sunsets and the wildlife, the mahi-mahi, the whales, like all of this stunning footage that I can't believe I have a front row seat for, but also the way that they would open up to the camera in a way that they didn't previously. And that was so powerful. And they would even tell me, because then I would be with them on land. Like, don't forget, I'm not just like setting them out with cameras. I'm with them for a week, 10 days on land in Santa Barbara, in San Francisco, Santa Barbara, Hawaii, Samoa, and then Australia. So I'm really kind of their familiar face that they see when they're coming into land after months on the ocean. And so we just got closer and closer as friends, as, you know, colleagues, if you will, I guess, which sounds like the weirdest word, but like we would stay together when we were on land. And they really got to know me and my family and my spirit, and they'd watched the Empowerment Project. Like, I really became a member of the team. So to be very clear, again, I did not row across any ocean, but I was on the team, you know? And so the closer that they got to me as a person on land, the closer they got to the camera on the boat. And that was really, really powerful to watch. So as they continued rowing, they'd pick up the camera and then they would just say like, hey, Sarah, here's what's going on. Or like, hey, Sarah, this is what I'm feeling. Or I got your questions via email. I'm going to answer them. Like, okay, here's, you know, like it was like, they were just talking to a friend. And that's not something you can exactly like premeditate. It just happens. No. And I just instinctually knew that that's what had to happen for me to have a film. Right. So I would say that progression was a huge difficulty. And then there's just the fun things, like they dropped a camera on the bottom of the ocean. Of course they did. But luckily, I'm a great producer. And when I was heading out to Samoa, which is a very small island that does not have a Best Buy, let me tell you, Damien, there's no Best Buy on the island of Samoa. So knowing that, when I was preparing to go, I purchased all of the equipment they had on the boat again, just as a backup. Because right. I didn't know if they handed me the camera and it was no longer working and I didn't have another one to give them, what am I going to do? They're leaving for the next leg of the journey.
Yeah.
So I ended up repurchasing everything just as a backup. And sure enough, when they were coming into Samoa, we get this call on the satellite phone and Tony, the shore support, is like, Natalia's crying. And I'm like, oh my God, is she okay? Like, she hurt? And he's like, here, she wants to talk to you. I'm like, she wants to talk to me. Okay. And I pick up the sat phone. I'm like, are you all right? Like, I'm thinking she's hurt. And she's like, I'm so sorry. I dropped the camera off the side of the boat. And I was like, oh my God, it's okay. And like, we had lost like a week of footage because it was on the memory card and she hadn't downloaded it yet. Yeah. But keep in mind, this is like day 97 for them on the second leg of the journey. So I was like, we'll be okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that camera is hopefully a habitat for many a fish off the island of Samoa. But in this, you know, in a twisted way, I definitely was also patting myself on the back at the same time, being like, I'm a great producer and here's a brand new fresh camera and it's okay. So things like that happened. And we had drone stuff, you know, my wonderful husband, Ryan, who is not in the film industry whatsoever. We bought a drone. Again, my budget is tiny. I'm crowdfunding. I'm applying for grants. I'm pitching to production companies. I'm completely independent on this project, like just trying to figure out how to get it made. Like, they're going to be in Samoa around this time. I got to raise the money to get there, whether I'm ready or not. You know, like, it was so stressful and exciting for me behind the scenes. So again, although I did not row an ocean, as I say, like, I crossed a Pacific of my own just in the making of the film. And so with that said, like, when it came time to the aerial photography, I couldn't always afford to like fly a drone operator in or like hire someone local. So we purchased our own drone and my husband Ryan learned how to use it. We would go to the park every weekend and like be like, okay, if that's the boat, which they called Doris, like, okay, how can we practice a move circling this way and then circling this way? And my husband Ryan just like figured it out. And so by the time we got to Samoa, he was my drone operator. And sure enough, he crashed the drone. I mean, it gets crazier. Like, he was on his own on a beach and I'm like on a boat at sea capturing them coming in and this triumphant arrival. They're like running out of food day 97. I mean, just like the ultimate dramatic moment. And my husband Ryan's like flying this drone and he captures it. He gets the shot that he needs, but then the drone crashes and he had to go find it and he found it. And like, it was completely broken. And he comes back. He like finally finds me like hours later. I'm like, where have you been? Are you okay? And he just sort of like comes back with his tail between his legs, like holding this very broken Phantom 3 drone. And I'm like, I don't care. Is the memory card okay? And he's like, I don't know. But he didn't think that way because he's not a filmmaker. Yeah. So he like is like so sad handing me this drone. And I like pop out the micro SD card, this tiny SD card.
Yeah, yeah.
And we pop it in the computer. And sure enough, the footage was beautiful and perfect. And like, everything that I needed, the drone was like completely eviscerated, but I didn't care. It was all about like, you got it, you did it, you got the shot. So there were so many moments like that. I could go on and on, but like, it just, so many things went quote wrong, but make for the best stories. And it was just such an adventure. Like, I miss it. I miss the exhilarating feeling of like being on the ocean making that film. And I am so not someone who like hangs off the side of a boat with a camera, but that was me. Yeah. You know, like, you just, it's amazing what you're capable of when you allow yourself that space to be free, you know. And again, I didn't have a boss. There was no executive producer on board, no production company, no one to report to. Like, and in some ways that was sad and lonely. And in other ways, it was like completely empowering that there was really no one to call to be like, hey, did I do this right? Like, I was in charge of the whole thing. And so that was just unbelievably empowering. And by the time they made it all the way to Australia. And again, I come back from this like crazy trip to Australia and I'm sitting there with all these hard drives and same feeling. Although I will say it was a lot more encouraging. I was like, I can't believe I have all this footage and it's safe. Like, they made it and this is such a miracle. Like, I just remember like weeping. Me and hard drives have all these emotional moments, I guess, but like, I'm just like looking at these hard drives thinking like, I can't believe they did it. And I can't believe we captured it. And like, the film is definitely in there, you know, and now it's just up to us to put it together. And so I spent about, you know, again, 7, 8, 9 months in post-production with my wonderful editor, Peter Serafim. And that was just such a joy. I think after all that struggle and stress and like, will they make it? What's going to happen? Will the footage be safe? You know, will they remember to turn on the microphone? Will they be vulnerable on camera? Like all those questions. Once we got into post-production, it was just like such a joy, like such a celebration of, wow, I can't believe that this film is like right here in front of me. Like, it just felt like the greatest gift. And so we spent all this time putting it together. And then again, I had, you know, still raising money as I'm editing, like applying for grants, and finally started to get a little bit of funding to the door. I had investors come on board. I had to really beg, borrow, and steal to make this film happen. And then the very happy ending is that I got a sales agent on board. Once I was very close to finishing the film, I signed with a sales agent, and that person helped me sell the film to Netflix, which was the greatest dream come true for the film. I wanted an international, worldwide audience. I felt like the film was timeless and evergreen and universal. You know, it doesn't have borders. It's literally them rowing across the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
So I thought this doesn't need, it's not a US story or a UK story or a South African story. Like it's a global story.
Completely.
And so knowing that Netflix is, I think, still the biggest platform in the world. And so when my sales agent helped me, we made a licensing deal to Netflix for 3 years. So it premiered on Netflix in 190 countries. Like I still get like choked up when I say that. Yeah, on May 1st, 2017. And it was on the platform for 3 years. And it was just the greatest time to be able to share their story with an audience of that magnitude. And I still hear from people on social media, like all the time, saying that they're watching it and getting inspired by it. Some fun tidbits, like this guy told me he had downloaded the film on Netflix and watched it on his laptop on his way up climbing Mount Everest.
Wow.
Which is like, what? And I've had plenty of people say they're like gonna row across the Atlantic. Like, I'm not kidding. Various people have been like, I watched this instead of shore. I'm gonna do, there's this like Atlantic Ocean whiskey challenge where you can row across for like 30 days. I don't mean to minimize it. I think that's incredible. I could never do it, but it's like still people are like, I'm on the rowing machine at the gym thinking about the rowers, or
yes,
Totally. Or like, my mom has breast cancer and watching your film made her feel better in her time. It's like all of it. I mean, I'm in my office right now and I printed up some of my favorite tweets. Like one of them says, if you haven't fallen in love in a while, watch Losing Side of Shore. I think the film transcends gender. This is awe-inspiring stuff for everyone. I mean, just things like that. Just, it's so much bigger than me. It's bigger than them. Like, it's just at a certain point, these films just grow up and move out and like thrive in the world. And it's like the greatest joy to see that happen. And they're the gift that keeps on giving. Like, here we are in 2022 and I get to talk to you about this today and like fill my heart with joy. And I made this film 5 years ago, right? So yeah. It's just so cool. And so the film is no longer on Netflix, but it's on iTunes, Amazon. It was on DirecTV for a while. It's on a bunch of like smaller channels. So it's still very much available for anyone to watch in the world. If you just search Losing Side of Shore on YouTube, you can see the trailer, losingsideofshore.com. But yeah, it was an adventure of a lifetime. That's for sure.
And I'll be putting all the links to where the films are available in the show notes. So everybody check out the show notes and really, really, you know, look at some of Sarah's work and definitely watch the film. It's well worth watching. Very inspiring. And it makes you think what you can do if you put your mind to it. And it also is a good example of what filmmaking can do, especially what you said about how you've made it. And I'm just so happy for you that your husband took the drone work on, because yes. That's just far out. Is he a creative professionally as well?
I mean, he's a very creative person, but no. He like works in sales. He's like he loves beer. He makes his own beer, bagels. He's very like good with his hands, very innovative, creative in many capacities, but it was a really beautiful journey for us as well. Like, he came with me to Hawaii, to Samoa, to Australia. My dad came to Australia as well. Again, I did not have a budget to hire a whole crew. Like, my greatest magic trick is if you watch Losing Sight of Shore and think, wow, this movie must have cost $1 million. Like,
it does look like that.
When you're, I mean, luckily I have the gorgeous ocean as like the perfect backdrop, but yeah. This was totally, yeah, the little engine that could again. And, you know, what's the best part for me about getting the Netflix deal was that I didn't get into Sundance, right? I got rejected from Sundance. I did not have a celebrity executive producer on board. Everyone is always posting these like deadline articles of all these like announcements of so-and-so is signed on to direct this and so-and-so is doing this project. And you're like, cool. Like, there's never been a deadline article with me in it. It's like, I'm sort of the the opposite of that. Like, I'm just so fiercely independent. And when something happens, there's a story I want to tell, I figure out how to tell it. And if the right partners come on board, wonderful. But with a film like Losing Sight of Shore, it's like, I just kept getting further and further. And at a certain point you're like, well, do I even need a production company anymore? Like, look how far I've come. And I was pitching and pitching and pitching while they were out on the ocean to production companies, distributors, anybody that would talk to me. And everyone said, wow, what an incredible story. Let me know when they make it. And that is the most frustrating thing to hear when you're in your time of need. You're like, how am I going to get to Samoa? How am I going to pay for Australia? Like, you're just looking at your computer, like, what do I do? And so, you know, it makes you understand that you really got to rely on yourself. And like, if you're passionate about something, you've got to be the driver. You have to be your biggest fan. And if it's worth telling, you'll figure out how to tell it one way or another. You will figure it out because you have to. You know, if it's sort of like, if you don't have to do it, then you probably won't do it. It's just way too hard otherwise. Yeah. And then sprinkle in the naivete that we talked about. There's always room for some naivete in there.
Always room. There's always room. And when I watched the film, I see now you emotionally connected to the people in the film. But when I watched it, I won't give any spoilers away, but there was a certain moment where one of the people on the boat started to cry like a lot for a particular reason that all of us would have cried for. How does that affect you and your decisions as a filmmaker when you know someone is so far away from their family in that situation?
I don't know. I think when I saw moments like that, and there's a few in the film where you just kind of, your heart breaks for them, I thought, well, this is it. Like, this is the human part of it. Like, if this wasn't there, then what did they really feel? You know, like that, when I see a moment like that, and for everyone listening, it's just like a deeply emotional moment where they felt so far away from their family, like, and they literally were, you know, even if they had wanted to go home in that moment, there just wasn't a way to do that. Like, it's the ultimate isolation, feeling of isolation. I don't know, when I saw that moment in the footage, it just was so beautiful to me. Like, what an example of what it means to be human, you know? And that's the movie, right? It's like that, those are the moments that I was looking for, and not in an exploitative kind of way, not in a reality TV kind of way, to be very clear, in like a human, this is life kind of way. Like, what a beautiful example of what it means to be emotional, what it means to be human, and what it means for these women to come together and to persevere and to make it to the other side. I mean, there's just nothing better than that to me. So when I saw those moments in the footage, that's when my heart would swell and I would feel like, well, this is the movie, you know, this is, without this, it is just about the wind and the weather and the rain, you know, it's so much more than that.
And one thing I know for sure is you're busy. I just know that. I want to know what is coming up next from you.
Oh my goodness. Well, you're right. I'm a mom now. I have two kids. I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. So honestly, like, to be completely transparent, it's really hard to be a filmmaker and to be a mom of young kids at this moment in my life, but I'm doing my best to keep my dreams alive. Since making Losing Sight of Shore, I made another feature length documentary called Nevertheless, which is all about sexual harassment in the workplace. This was 2017 to 2020. I was pregnant with my daughter when I was just feeling such a responsibility to make the world any bit safer for her to exist in. And so I started interviewing employment attorneys and human resource representatives and brave men and women willing to share their story with me. This was right as the Me Too movement was being reignited. And so that was quite a journey. That's a whole other podcast to talk about. But that film, if anyone's interested, you can go to neverthelessfilm.com or on Instagram. You'll see it in my, on my page at Sarah Moshman, S-A-R-A-H-M-O-S-H-M-A-N. And most recently, I directed a narrative film, a short film based on a true story. It's called Unbound, and it's based on the true story of Dr. Anna Lee Fisher, who is the first mother to go into space. So it's this incredible 10-minute short, which I'm really proud of. We shot it back in December and it's on the festival circuit now. But basically, Anna Fisher was chosen for a mission to space when she was 8 months pregnant. She trained for 14 months. To be very clear, she did not go into space pregnant. She trained for 14 months. And then in November 1984, she was the first mother to go into space. And so the film is really following between the moment when she's asked to go and deciding to go, and then the moment she steps on the shuttle. And it's really like an examination of the intersection of motherhood and ambition, which is all I think about these days. But yeah, I'm really, really proud of the film, and we just won some exciting awards, and I want to make more and more narrative films. Documentary still has my heart, not saying no to anything these days, but I would like to do more narrative filmmaking in the future. So yeah.
What is it in particular about narrative filmmaking that makes you want to do it more than documentaries?
Yeah, I wouldn't even say it's like more. It's just I love the process. Like with documentary, they really are the inverse of each other. Like it's all under the umbrella of storytelling for me in my head. Like it's all just a different form of storytelling. And I think my documentary filmmaking skills only help me be a better narrative filmmaker. But what's cool about narrative is like, if you've done it right, you've planned everything out. And by the time you get to set, you're simply executing on the plan that you've all come together as a collaborative group, whether it's your production designer, your cinematographer, your actors, you know, your producers, your locations, like everything comes together. And on the shoot day, hopefully everyone's on the same page and you're simply executing on the vision. Things will change, of course. But I was so inspired to work with so many talented people on a narrative film and just really be able to see everyone shine and come together under this umbrella of like, we all want to tell this story the best possible way. Like it was so much fun. And working with actors is a whole other world that I'm really interested in and appreciating and wanting to learn more about. And I love cinematography. And so every frame is so intentional, you know, it's like the lighting and the framing and the movement and the colors, like what a luxury it is to like plan out every frame. Yeah. Whereas in documentary, nothing against it, but like even last week I had a shoot where I did 4 sit down interviews. And I'm showing up to the location with a car full of gear. It's just me. You know, I hire crew when I can, but so often there's so little budget. So I end up shooting stuff myself sometimes. And that's cool. But it's just like, I show up to the location on the day. I'm like looking for what's the best frame in the moment. You know, I've got like 20 minutes to set it up. Can everyone be quiet so that I can get this interview? Can I create that connection with someone and get them to open up and be intimate with me and share their story? It's just a totally different, you know, part of the brain skill set. It's all storytelling, but narrative is just this like slower, methodical, collaborative, beautiful art form to me. And documentary is like, okay, be adaptable, show up and figure it out. And I think both have merit and are both very exciting to me. And I would never be like, I'm done making documentaries. But I think there's so much to explore in narrative filmmaking, but it is harder to get off the ground because it's more expensive, right? You need a cast and a crew and locations and wardrobe and a script, you know? And with documentary, if you told me there was an exciting story happening right outside my door, I could pick up my phone and get going, you know? So it's just different forms of storytelling. And I appreciate both for different reasons, but I would love to expand my narrative filmmaking kind of portfolio as I move forward.
And why not? That's what I say.
Why not?
And I look forward to watching your narrative short film.
Thank you.
I haven't seen it, so I look forward to seeing that one.
Oh yeah, I can send you a link to watch it, or we're on the festival circuit now, so we'll probably do an online release at some point. But we've been winning some awards. We've gotten into like 9 festivals, so it's been really exciting. Yeah, thank you.
if you can send me the link, I'd love that, because I'd love to watch that. Especially like the contrast, as we've spoken about, between narrative and documentary filmmaking. I'd love to see your take on doing a narrative film.
Yeah, it is funny. And then at its core, when you think about it, it's like the story of Anna Fisher, same thing, ordinary woman doing something extraordinary. It's all the same, you know, like at its core, those are the stories that I want to tell. And so it's exciting that even in narrative filmmaking, in narrative filmmaking, I was able to bring sort of this based on a true story element to it. So it all goes together in my head. So it's been cool to see the evolution.
Great stuff. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. And well done again for all your success and all the films you've done. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on Filmmaking Conversations.
If you like this podcast, share it with friends. Leave a comment in the comment section and hit the subscribe button.